Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Groundwire was produced on the traditional unceded territory of the Clatley Tene at Seifer in Prince George, BC. We are your hosts, Laura Smith
and Grant Bichand. On today's episode,
We have an extremely toxic drug supply right now, and that's because of prohibition and an unregulated supply. As a society, we really need to be rethinking about our approach to drugs and potentially looking at decriminalization and regulation.
Whether it's the Charter of Values, whether it's the election of Donald Trump, whether it's the rise of the far-right parties in France and Europe, and the recent adoption of law of Bill 62, are just demonstrations of a continuity of racism here in Quebec, and we're here to walk together, largely in large numbers, to denounce clearly and openly hate and racism, and to make racists afraid again.
Our first headline comes from Grassy Narrows. A proposed provincial law requires the Ontario Minister of Environment to establish a trust with $85 million for cleaning up mercury in the English Wabagoon River. Chief Simon Fobister of Grassy Narrows said in a press release, "This legislation is a historic milestone in my people's long fight to make our poisoned river flow with life again, and to gain justice for our people." But is $85 million enough to clean up the river and heal the sick? The proposed legislation comes from more than 50 years after a paper mill began dumping 9 tons of untreated mercury waste into the English Wabagoon River in 1962. Today, the community of Grassy Narrows is suffering from chronic health, economic, and cultural crisis due to mercury. Judy Da Silva, Grassy Narrows Environmental Health Coordinator, grandmother, and mercury survivor, points to the need for a mercury home and treatment center where the sick can be cared for in the community. At this time, the source of mercury contamination in the river is still ongoing and has yet to be found. With no date set for the cleanup, the community of Grassy Narrows is seeking greater accountability and timely action from the Government of Ontario.
Our next headline comes from The Aquanian, an independent student-owned and operated publication at St. Thomas University. The entire St. Thomas University men's basketball squad took a knee recently to raise awareness for missing and murdered Indigenous women and children in Canada. The action took place during the O Canada. Some team members held up a red shawl while their teammates and coaches kneeled. A moment of silence also took place after the anthem for victims of violence in Indigenous communities. Kiera Gerben, an Indigenous representative for the local students' union, addressed the crowd, stating, "It's important to note that violence in Aboriginal communities is not traditional." Gerben added, "It's time we stop looking at Indigenous issues as a social and psychological, but instead acknowledge the systematic racism and assimilative policy that creates those problems for us." The protest took place 1 month after the University of New Brunswick hosted the Red Shawl campaign to honor missing and murdered Aboriginal women and their families. Imelda Purley, the UNB elder in residence, said in a news release at the time, "The Red Shawl signifies healing for victims' families." She added, "The Red Shawl is a symbol of protection and what a young girl earns on her way to becoming a woman." That's it for headlines. We'll be right back after this.
I was born on the Tijon Road, in a stand of trees where the willow grows, in a little house made of earth and wood. There's a place that I call home for good. In the dark, waiting for the morning lark.
Johnny come from Bellingham. He ran away from Vietnam. Now he lives down in Dome Creek. He makes his living hauling trees. Yeah, he makes his living hauling trees. Oh.
You just heard Tejon Road by Black Spruce Bog.
Welcome back to Groundwire, your source for news from the ground up. Available online at www.groundwirenews.ca and airing on your community radio stations.
Now it's time for our feature stories. According to the Chief Coroner for Ontario, 173 people in Toronto died of opioid overdoses in 2016. On August 12th, a group of drug users and harm reduction workers defied the law to set up an unsanctioned overdose prevention site in a park in Toronto's east to try to stem the deaths. As the site reaches its third month of operation, volunteers are struggling not only against the deadly cocktail of contaminated street drugs, but also the weather and the government that they say isn't doing nearly enough. CJRU's Mick Sweetman provides Groundwire this update with Nick Boyce from Toronto's Overdose Prevention Society.
Nick, can you tell us a little bit about how the Overdose Prevention Society has been operating the site for the past 3 months?
Sure. So it was in response to the inadequate response of all levels of government to the current overdose crisis we're experiencing across the country. In 2016, over 895 people died from opioid overdose in Ontario, and the government has just not been getting its act together. So there were a bunch of concerned community activists, harm reduction workers, and community members that came together and said, "We've seen enough dead people. We need to do something about this." We picked Moss Park because there's a high level of activity of drug use in that area, has been for years, and there have been dead people in that park. So we showed up August 12th on a Saturday afternoon and erected some tents in the park. Within those tents, we allow people to use illicit drugs, primarily by injection. And we have medically trained personnel that can respond in the case of people overdosing.
And do you know how many times you have had people either using on the site or where you've had to respond to an overdose?
In the first 82 days, so we're longer than that now, but we have data on the first 82 days, we witnessed over 2,000 injections, and we stopped or reversed 85 overdoses. So those are people that would be in emergency departments costing thousands of dollars or dead.
And like obviously you set this site up without getting prior permission from Health Canada or other levels of government. And they've allowed you to keep operating it, but it's getting harder now, isn't it, as the temperatures drop? Can you just tell us a little bit about, you know, what has been happening recently for our listeners in terms of, you know, overcoming this, not only the overdose crisis, but also Toronto's like, increasingly cold weather?
Yeah, there's a couple of things there, but some of the local city councils are not happy with us being there. There's a lot of stigma around drug use, and they just want us out of the park. But I think there's a recognition that we're also saving lives. So there'd been a plan in the background. We've been working on a plan to try and move inside. We also knew colder weather was coming. So we've been working with one of the local social service agencies to try and move inside in an unsanctioned site. The process and the approval process to get a sanctioned site takes a really long time. There's real barriers to that. But this agency said hopefully we could move inside. We're also entirely volunteer-driven. We have 130 volunteers on that we're working with, plus 43 medical volunteers. There's a core group of five or six of us coordinating all this. We're burning out. It's been 3 months. We're doing this on top of our regular jobs. We're there 7 days a week. So we also secured some funding through the Ministry of Health, through the Toronto Central LHIN to provide funding for this. But that plan all fell apart when that agency's board of directors said, actually, no, you need to get a sanctioned site. You can't come in without an exemption from Health Canada.
Toronto's not the only place right now. There were both sanctioned and unsanctioned overdose prevention sites are operating. Mm-hmm. Can you just tell our listeners a bit about what it's like in some of the other cities and how those cities are in those provinces are responding that might be a little different than here in Toronto?
Yeah, well, the obvious place we hear a lot about what's happening in BC because the crisis is just so much worse there. They've opened numerous overdose prevention sites unsanctioned, but one of the ways they've been able to do that was the provincial government, their health minister, wrote what's called a ministerial order, which basically says, regardless of federal law, we'll allow these to operate. We've been calling for a similar kind of thing here in Ontario, for the Ontario government to declare a public health emergency. That could enact certain legislation or ways of moving money and enabling resources much more quickly. If you look at how we've responded to other health crises in the past, you know, with the SARS crisis, for example, there were millions of dollars of resources enabled really quickly. We're just not seeing that kind of response here in Ontario. And again, the idea of a tent was nice, but what we've been saying is we need trailers, we need an indoor space. That's really our preference. And these overdose prevention sites in BC or in other cities, that's what they're using is these trailers right now.
Mm-hmm. So, Nick, what else can the government do that they're not doing currently?
It's really giving it the attention this deserves. This is across the province, across the country, putting the resources that are needed into it. But there are bigger picture things too. We have an extremely toxic drug supply right now, and that's because of prohibition and an unregulated supply. As a society, we really need to be rethinking about our approach to drugs and potentially looking at decriminalization and regulation.
Thanks to CJRU for that report.
Our final feature comes from CKUT's Community News Collective. From the election of Donald Trump as President of the United States and the recent passing Quebec's Bill C-62 on the so-called religious neutrality that targets Muslim women who cover their face to everyday acts of violence and hate speech, many local organizers and communities are mobilizing against increasing far-right extremism. On Sunday, November 12th, thousands of protesters, including those representing over 160 organizations, marched against hatred and racism in downtown Montreal. Reporting from this mass demonstration are CKUT correspondents Julia Bugil and Goshika Mahidaki.
We're here today to demonstrate against hate and racism. We're not witness to singular or unique, isolated events of racism, but rather we are witness to a deep-seated racism that is crystallizing itself today. Whether it's the Charter of Values, whether it's the election of Donald Trump, whether it's the rise of the far-right parties in France and Europe, and the recent adoption of law of Bill 62, are just demonstrations of a continuity of racism here in Quebec. And we're here to walk together, largely in large numbers, to denounce clearly and openly hate and racism, and to make racists afraid again.
My name is Sabine Friesinger. I'm a co-president of Alternatives. And I'm here today to say no to racism. I'm very happy to see this large turnout. It shows that Quebec is a place where it's really social movements and civil society that get to dictate in the streets the mood of the city, basically. We saw it also with the elections, the municipal elections. Montreal is expressing itself and saying that, you know, no more racism in Quebec, no more.
My name is Vincent Musso. I'm the Vice President Internal of the Social Work Student Association, also a U1 social work student at McGill, and organized our presence in the rally here. We think it's important that we challenge, of course, hatred and racism for obvious reasons. It goes against the realities of our profession, but also we think it's really important that we call this out because legislation that is fueled by racism and Islamophobia, like Bill 62, is going to have a direct impact on the students that are practicing our profession right now, but also on the populations that we will or will not be able to serve in the future. And we think it's unacceptable that our profession is being used in order to enable this type of violence against racialized people.
Hi, so my name's Kristen. I'm with AVEC, which is the Association for the Voice of Education in Quebec, and I'm the Mobilization Coordinator. AVEC is basically an association that's representing students across Quebec, and of course we have a lot of racialized students as well, so it's especially important for us to be here today, you know, as some of us racialized students ourselves, and also supporting, for those who are not, our students across the province, and also just to stand in solidarity with racialized people in Quebec, all over the world, who are trying to come to Quebec as well. And I think it's really important to be able to support the people that are marginalized often in society, and so this is one of the reasons that we're here today. You know, even just being able to demonstrate freely and the ability to have your face covered and use public services is really important. And, you know, Bill 62 is something that's restricting access to people who need those services, so we thought it was really unjust, and we're kind of taking a strong position against that. We have a lot of Indigenous solidarity that we have as well in our values, so it's really important to remember, you know, whose land we're on right now and the ongoing impacts of colonization right now, you know.
Aside from events like this, what would you say are good ways for people who are interested in combating racism and who are against things like Bill 62 to take a stand and to get involved?
So, I mean, when it comes to policy, it's pretty clear that you can get involved by contacting your representatives. So, for the case of Bill 62, for example, it might be the Ministry of Justice who you'd want to contact, or also your local representatives. And I think that's always a really important thing, is just the kind of the representation part and using your voice as a constituent in Quebec. I think it was really positive to see so many people out, and, you know, the organizers really did a lot of work to make sure a lot of groups joined on and signed on. I think there's over 150 last time I checked, and, you know, just hundreds of groups across the province coming together to say no to hate, no to racism, and, you know, yes to refugees and immigrants and racialized people, and supporting them, saying that Black lives matter, saying that Indigenous lives matter, you know, all of these issues that sometimes are not spoken about as much or are only spoken about by a very small group of people. We saw today how people were coming together to be in solidarity with each other, you know. Yeah, basically calling for support for all of the people that are needing it, especially when you talk about racism. And so it was really positive to see that, and I'm really glad that we were able to be here as an association, because, you know, we're representing our students, and this is an issue that impacts a lot of our students.
I'm Dr. Abraham Weisfeld, a PhD in political science from UQAM, and I'm with the Alliance of Concerned Jewish Canadians and the Palestinian-led association, DSTT Culture. And I'm here, standing here at the demonstration, holding a Palestine flag. Canada is one of the few supporters of the Zionist State of Israel in the United Nations. In the United Nations, Canada votes with the United States and Israel against resolutions denouncing the occupation of the West Bank, etc., the colonization that is proceeding there.
What is the purpose of organizing here in a mass demonstration?
Well, because the neo-Nazi right wing, you know, is trying to mobilize now. They've gotten a certain sort of motivation, you know, because of the U.S. President Trump, you know, who is condoning their racism, in effect. And so we have to mobilize to show that there's more people opposed to racism than who are in favor of racism. And that way, you know, other people, you know, who are not aware or not paying attention will realize that they don't have to sort of go along with those people who are promoting racism and disguising it as something else. So we are removing the disguise of racism, denouncing it, and asserting the program of integration in society. Not assimilation, mind you, but integration. We will not allow ourselves to be expelled again. And all the other, you know, national minorities will not allow ourselves to be treated as if we don't belong and we don't count.
That report was filed from occupied territories of the Mohawk peoples, one of the five keepers of the Eastern Doors, by CKUT's Community News Collective.
Welcome back to Groundwire, your source for independent grassroots news, available online at www.groundwirenews.ca and airing on your local community radio station. Now it's time for the Community Radio Report. The International Institute for Communications gathered November 14th and 15th for its annual conference in Ottawa. Participants were addressed by Ian Scott, the news chair of the Canadian Radio, Television, and Telecommunications Commission. Gretchen King from CKUT prepared this report from the conference's discussion on regulating defamation, hate speech, and fake news in Canada.
How will Canada regulate uncivil discourse in the media? Experts of law, media, and public policy debated this question during events hosted by the IIC in Ottawa. While the Criminal Code of Canada once made the spreading of false news a punishable offense, how should defamation, hate speech, and misinformation be regulated in today's multi-platform environment? In response to the impact of fake news in recent elections, Facebook launched the Canadian Election Integrity Initiative. But does self-regulation work? Professor Marina Pavlovic from the Center for Law, Technology, and Society at the University of Ottawa thinks the drive for higher profits supersedes self-regulation initiatives.
The fundamental issue is that this permeates different contexts, that fake news is just one area, and that if you look at predatory journals and fake scientific conferences, if you look at pseudoscience, if you look at paid influencers, that it's all working in a somewhat regulated or somewhat unregulated environment with a tremendous commercial opportunity. And that's what's really being exploited, that there is a lot of money to be made on all of these issues. And so the platforms themselves do not necessarily have an incentive to regulate any of this. And again, contexts are somewhat different in between fake news and, you know, fake scientific conferences, but there is really no incentive for self-regulation, because self-regulating effectively means that there won't be as much profit as otherwise could be made.
Edward Greenspun, president and CEO of the Public Policy Forum, responded that regulation is needed, especially because the internet advertising market is consolidated.
Right now, the platforms are held to a lower standard of disclosure than the broadcasters, particularly, who are regulated, and print, who are regulated in terms of electoral expectations. You know, unfortunately, I say this as a former gatekeeper of a newspaper who got to decide what you guys got to read every day. We're not going back to those days, of course. And indeed, it's a good thing that we're not going back to those days in many ways. But if the internet indeed is consolidated, as you say, hugely consolidated, in Canada last year, 83.4% of ads were served by those two companies, by Google and Facebook, 83.4%. Canadian publishers, broadcasters, et cetera, combined served 11% of ads. So you've got consolidation, pollution, you have structural issues.
Regulation and education go hand in hand, according to Professor Pavlovic.
So I think shifting of responsibility is something that I'm somewhat concerned about, that it's always on the end user or the consumer of information to educate themselves, and that by doing that we're shielding those who may actually have power to change the narrative and change the conversation, because there may not necessarily be the interest. And then if we go towards the regulation route, who regulates, how do we regulate, and how do we enforce that regulation? And we're not dealing with single corporate structures, we're dealing with multiple complex corporate structures, and it's very easy to set the structure up so that it's not necessarily subject to regulation. Are you carrying on business in Canada? Well, you don't have offices, you're not doing this and that, and therefore that is really not the single answer, and if we go with that, there will be also a generational gap. If we teach the youth, how do we really reach the others who are not in the system right now?
One of the lessons learned from this year's International Institute for Communications Conference is that community radio stations are in a great position to provide all ages access to news literacy. Reporting for Groundwire, this is Gretchen King from CKUT in Jojage, otherwise known as Montreal.
Thanks to CKUT for that report.
You just heard Long Shots by Crones. That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced at Seifer in Prince George on the traditional unceded territory of the Klaitli Tene. I've been your host, Laura Smith.
And your co-host, Grant Bashand.
Music this week was by Black Spruce Bog and Crones. We thank all of our amazing contributors in this episode, as well as Gretchen King and Oma Shelma Rehevtula for their editing and coordination help. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwirenews.ca.